Hi everyone, I'm Lisa.
And I'm Nick.
And you're listening to It Takes Two, the podcast where two people take two movies with the same plot or premise and watch and discuss them.
And before we start, we'd like to apologize because we thought this was going to be not a remakes episode, but unfortunately it's a remakes episode.
I'm very sorry that we've got two remakes episodes back to back. It has happened because I thought that these were both adaptations from the same source material, because I, as a 12 or 13 year old, read the book that I thought these movies were based on. Turns out the book was a novelization of the first of these movies, and the second one is, in fact, a remake. So this is a remakes episode, but our next remakes episode isn't until March, so you get a bit of a break from remakes.
So in this episode, we're covering off 1947's A Miracle on 34th Street and 1994's A Miracle on 34th Street.
Did you say on 47th Street?
I was going to, yes.
It's also just Miracle on 34th Street. There's no "at" in there.
I should have read that from the Wikipedia page I'm currently looking at.
You were so focused on getting the years right that you forgot about the name of the movie.
Correct.
Yes, this is Miracle on 34th Street.
Christmas episode.
Yes, happy Christmas. This one is...
Merry Christmas.
I think coming out slightly post-Christmas, but still December.
Post-Christmas.
Post-Christmas. This is a post-Christmas Christmas episode. Yeah, I hadn't seen either of these before. Had you?
I think, as we discussed, while we were watching... the one from 47.
Yeah.
There is a bunch of references and like zeitgeists that has evolved into sort of pop culture.
Yeah.
And I remember a lot of references from The Simpsons, but I had never actually seen the movie.
Yeah. And I had read, like I mentioned, I'd read the novelization of the 1947 movie, thinking that that was, well, I mean, I was a child, so it didn't matter what I thought. But even as an adult, I thought that was the book that these were based on. So it was a revelation to discover that, in fact, it was a novelization of the first movie.
And it's a revelation to the court system, proving that Santa Claus is a real guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pretty much the plot of these movies, it's such a wild story.
Yeah, and it is, like, they do mostly stick to the same in both.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I knew about these being about, this is actually the real Santa Claus who ends up working in a store. And I knew there was a court case. I didn't know the ins and outs of why there was a court case. But also, like, what's never really addressed is, why is the real Santa Claus living in an old folks' home in New York?
It's a good question.
That's what I want to know.
Well, maybe Mrs. Claus took the house in the divorce?
I don't think so. It's certainly in the remake, because in both versions you get to see his little employment card. And in the remake, certainly, it says he's married, so he's not divorced. That is, I don't know why I noticed that, but it does, in fact, specify that he's married. But yet, he still lists his next of kin as Dasher and Dancer and Donner and Blitzen.
Here's a question for you.
Yeah.
That is unrelated to these movies.
Oh, okay.
Do you understand the plot of the Santa Claus, talking of, like, Santa and...
Which also came out in 1994?
Yes.
Yes.
He has to get married.
Is that in the second one,
that's
right?
That's the second one. That's the whole plot of the second one, is Tim Allen as Santa has to get married.
Yeah.
What happened to the previous wife of the...
That's a good question.
Anyway, moving on.
Maybe she just gets to go home.
Like when...
And
when
be
the Khaleesi...
And sadly be a widow.
When the Carl dies and the Khaleesi has to go back to the thing and join the widows... Game of Thrones.
I know what Game of Thrones. I know who the Khaleesi is. I don't know what that whole thing is. And also, what was going on in my brain was, is it appropriate to even discuss Game of Thrones in a child-friendly episode of the podcast?
Oh, yeah, it's a child-friendly episode. unless Game you're Australian, share this with your under 16-year-old. Because they banned social media in Australia recently.
Yeah, but you can still, like, sit and listen to it with your child.
True.
That they your child doesn't need to have social media to be able to listen to a podcast.
Can't with listen to us on YouTube.
Family.
Or Reddit. No, they were on Reddit.
I mean, Kick, you can't Twitch. Listen to us on Reddit anyway.
Could have we embedded a video of our YouTube link. We're also on YouTube. We haven't done shorts in ages.
No. We're too busy.
We're so busy.
Our lives have been busy.
Our lives have been consumed with Christmas movies, which we're supposed to be talking about.
Yes.
Which one of these, I'm going to ask you questions, because this is the new format that I've decided that I'm doing now. I'm interviewing you. Yeah. Which of these, you hadn't seen either. No. So we've covered that off. Yeah. That's usually the first question. Second question, which one did you enjoy more?
It's a tough one. I think probably the original.
You enjoyed the original more.
But it's interesting. Yeah, because I think I didn't like what they did with the court case in the remake.
I think, yeah.
I liked how that ended up. The court case in the original.
In the original is far more sort of like, that whole throwaway. So when I was talking about the reference that's in The Simpsons earlier, it's from an episode where Homer is suing an all-you-can-eat fast food, a seafood restaurant. Because they kick him out because he's eaten too much seafood. He goes to court, and in the court, they use a clip from... They reimagine a clip from the original 47 version where they display to the court how much shrimp Mr. Simpson ate. And then it has the scene from the court case where... They bring on the bags. Because the postal system in the 47 movie have decided that, hey, I've got a really good idea to how to get rid of all that undeliverable mail.
And it's because one girl, Susan, who's the main kind of child in the movie, writes a letter to Kris Kringle and addresses it
to the courthouse.
And then they're like, haha, this is funny. And they're like, no, he's on trial there at the moment. And then they decide they're going to deliver all of the undelivered Santa letters to him.
Yeah.
And therefore, he is recognized by the United States federal government as the real Santa Claus.
50,000 letters addressed to Santa Claus.
Yeah, and the thing that annoyed me in both of these movies...
Oh, yes.
...is how the mother is treated by everyone around her. But I think it's kind of worse in the remake. Because she's very much, in the original, she's very much, and it's in the 1940s, which is so crazy.
Yeah, there's a lot
But she's very much like this strong, independent businesswoman.
Yeah.
Who is like raising this highly intelligent child by herself.
Possibly on the spectrum, especially in the 94 version.
Yeah. Yeah, this really highly intelligent child, and she's running a bit. She's not the head of a business, but she's like running a whole kind of section of the business essentially. And she runs the Macy's Day Parade, the Kohl's Day Parade in the remake. I didn't find her character as strong in the remake, whereas Maureen O'Hara in the 1947 one is like very much this very. She knows exactly who she is and what she's doing and whatever. And then it really annoyed me that the neighbor, Mr. Gailey, just undermines her parenting constantly.
Yeah.
And I don't like that, like, because he is basically her love interest in both movies. And he's called Bedford in the remake after the town that It's a Wonderful Life is set in. But, yeah, he really, in the 1947 one, he's just undermines her parenting at every intersection. And it's not even that, like, he talks to her about it and says, hey, I think you should do this, blah, blah, blah. I mean, so he does kind of have that conversation, but then he, like, immediately goes against her wishes and does things she doesn't want with her child while she's busy trying to be a single mom.
Yeah.
And raising money, but working to earn her keep so that she can, you know, look after her kid. And I really just didn't like the way he did that. And then in the remake, I don't think she stands as strong as a character. I don't think she has the, like, the strength and the courage of her convictions and stuff that the 1947 one does. I think she's a little bit more lost, and things kind of happen to her by accident more so than they do in the 1947 one. And then, like, the guy, and she does end up with him in the end, but he, there's, like, a moment where he turns, like, full nice guy on her.
Yeah.
Where, like, he proposes to her out of nowhere, and then she's like, look, I'm sorry if I gave you the wrong impression. Marriage isn't what I'm looking for right now, you know, and we get this backstory that she's had a really bad experience with her previous husband, who's the daughter's father. And he immediately is like, I love your child and I don't get any rewards for it. I love you and I don't get anything in return. And it's like, you don't love someone for the rewards. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just felt like, especially then for her to end up with him at the end, felt like they just really don't like women. Kind of my thought, but I do like that in the first one, you know, in the original one, she is a very strong character, and very independent, very self-sufficient, and knows exactly who she is and what she wants, and knows exactly what she's teaching her child and who she wants her child to grow up to be, not in terms of, like, telling her what job to have or whatever, but, like, in terms of what her values should be, what she, you know, the fact that she should be well-educated and she should be not falling into, you know, the same kind of bad experiences that she had. Anyway, it's probably a weird thing to focus on for a Christmas episode.
It's no, because I think it's very relevant because these movies are from very, very different eras.
Yeah.
There's Susan for both movies, right?
Susan is the daughter. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and the mother is Doris in the original and Dory in the remake.
In the 47 one, she would have been born during the war.
Yes.
Which is possibly an explanation of why the dad's not in the picture.
Yeah.
It's very interesting because it is so early after World War II ended, in the United States anyway. And yeah, you sort of get, but even like, she would have been born in the 80s. If it was set in 94.
Yeah.
So even still, like, single working mother is kind of not super normal for that era as well.
Yeah.
Obviously, there would have been a huge rent difference price-wise, both of them living in New York, very, very close to, like,
Central Park,
which is crazy to me.
Yeah, the fact that the neighbor in both has a window that overlooks the route of the Macy's Day Parade.
Yeah.
Like, that's prime real estate.
He's a lawyer in both these movies, which kind of makes sense, because otherwise how would he defend Kris Kringle later on in court? Yeah. But yeah, like, she must be, like, because she's sort of, like, in charge of the parade and then sort of gets swept into the wing of, like, their marketing team, because, like, the CEO is like, no, I'm happy that Santa is telling people to go to other places because it makes our competitors look bad.
Yeah. She works in very close connection with the store manager of Macy's / Kohl's.
Yeah.
Mr. Shellhammer. And then they both report to, obviously, Mr. Macy Mr. Kohl.
Because, of course, you'd name the business out of yourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Macy's is named after a Mr. Macy.
Probably. Probably is.
But Kohl's was fictional.
Kohl's was fictional, except during in Australia.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's so funny that, like, they reached, you know, they grabbed, like, a made-up name for their made-up toy store, and to us, it's like, well, that's just a supermarket in Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just Kohl's. That was my local when I lived over there.
There was some weird rivalry in the 47 one between Kohl's and the competitive
Gimbals?
Company. Yeah.
That's a real thing.
Yeah.
But to the point that that's referenced in Elf, I think, as well, even though Macy's didn't exist anymore, I think, at that point.
It's way more supervillain-esque in the remake.
Yeah, it's like, I think at one point my notes referred to the duo that does Lamberg, is that his name? That does his bidding as Budget Team Rocket.
Yeah.
Because that's the feel you get from them.
They definitely have, like, some, like, cartoonish henchman vibe going on.
Yeah, yeah.
For a Mara Wilson movie, aka Matilda, what else she was in super famous for?
Mrs. Doubtfire. A Simple Wish was the movie I loved as a kid that she was in.
It's not surprising that, like, she gets followed around by, like, evil henchman-y type characters.
That's just her shtick, right?
Yeah, that's where she's typecast for. If you want a sweet young child who clearly is on the spectrum, who's being followed around by evil henchmen.
She just has such an expressive face. She was, by the way, just like a fantastic child actress.
Yeah.
Like, incredible acting chops from a very young age. And she seems like a really nice person as an adult. But yeah, she just has, like, such an expressive face that, like, she does, like, the unbridled joy really well, but then also, like, pulls at your heartstrings when she does, like, a sad face. Because it doesn't look like, it's not, like, cartoonish sad. It's, like, you look at her and it's like she's, like, experiencing grief over whatever it is. And you're like, no, this little child. She's only 8.
She did this before she did Matilda.
Yeah.
Didn't realize Matilda was 96.
Yeah, this is pre-Matilda.
Yeah. It's very interesting because, like you said earlier, the story evolves quite strangely. Because you have, you know, the single mum, the actual Santa Claus is disturbed by the fake Santa Claus for the parade because he's drinking.
Yeah.
Replaces him, then becomes the official Santa of the
toy store.
Yeah. Then ends up being harassed in both these movies to the point where he, like, snaps. Mm. But he's, like, built this relationship with the whole family and is, like... And, like, the girl is, like, such... It makes sense for the 47 one. I guess the mum has been hurt in 94 that, like, Susan has basically had this sort of realism embedded in her as a child.
Mm.
You know, I don't believe in fake things because fake things are lies and lies is where we end up in. Yeah,
and I think they said that Dory was a teenager when she got married first. Was that right?
Yeah.
Is that what they said? And then he turned out to be an alcoholic and then he left when the baby was born.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what they said. That she was a teenager. And I was like, ooh. That's a little bit of backstory that you didn't get in the original one. But I don't think that's the case. I think in the original one, we are supposed to infer. Because I don't think they say anything. Though they do have Susan explaining divorce to an adult in the original. So she understands divorce. So maybe it's not supposed to be a war widow thing.
I wasn't necessarily implying that he died during the war.
Yeah.
I'm sort of implying that... He probably came back from war or was injured in war or experienced some form of the conflict that was the war.
Yeah.
And not that it's an excuse for bad behavior in men seeing traumatic stuff and then bringing it home, but I'm saying there was no real... There's still not really a huge support for people who have seen things. And... you know, reintegrating themselves back into society. But there is a possibility that, you know, if she was so young, it could have been like, well, you know, the war's on, you know, make hay while the sun shines sort of material of like, you know, our love could be fleeting because we could lose or, So there is edge to that. The alcoholism, 70s, you know, it makes sense when you look at, like, how kids were raised in that era, what their parents went through. You're talking only a couple of generations in between the war and that time.
Did you say the 70s?
Yeah, because they would have been born in the 70s, right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right, I was like, what? Who would have been born in the 70s?
The mother and father of Susan in the 94 one. Because if she's young, like a teenager, she would have been in...
I think...
If we're
saying she's, like, 18...
Yeah. How old's the girl?
The girl is supposed to be 8, I think?
Yeah, so 8
So she would have born in 86.
Yeah, same year as me.
Yeah. So they would have... The mum then, if she was 18... If she got pregnant at 18, so then she would have been 18 in 85... then that would be 1967 that she was born.
Yeah. But you're a product of the era you're raised in rather than you're born in.
Yeah, fair.
Because if you're born in 89, you're still a 90s kid.
Yeah, that's fair.
So yeah, it could, you know, there could have been kids of the people returning back from the war. Still had Vietnam in there, in Korea.
A lot of wars.
Yeah, a lot of wars. We did pretty well, and well, if you don't pay attention to all the small conflicts. Anyway, back to Christmas. Yeah, no, it's very interesting because, like, the relationship that's built between, you know, Kris Kindle, the family, happens pretty quickly. Even though, as you mentioned earlier, the negativity of the 47, the father-esque figure.
And Santa as well, to be fair. They both kind of undermine her parenting in the 47 one. I think Santa does it less so in the remake.
Yeah.
And also I think that she maybe has a better relationship with Susan in the remake.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, I think her and Susan seem to get on really well in the original, but then it's like, oh, maybe I have set her up to not believe in things and that's not the way we want to do things, whatever. Whereas in the remake, they have a conversation where she's like, okay, well, you know, you've got to kind of choose for yourself, and then it's like, how about you do a test, and, you know, if you want to see if you believe this is a real Santa or not, you know, you could ask him for something that you would never ask me for, and then if you get it, you know, it's come from him, not from me. And also that, like, she has a conversation with her where she says, like, look, I don't believe that Santa is a real person, and these are the reasons why. And then the kid is like, well, I think I'm going to need some time to think on that.
Yeah.
And I love that answer where she's like, I need to gather my thoughts and my evidence before I make a decision one way or the other, whether I believe that A, Santa is real and this is him. I think that's kind of sweet.
What I find really fascinating was just looking back at it. It's, obviously, these are movies, right? It's not real life. But you have an individual who claims that he's actually Santa.
Yeah.
And then you leave your child unattended with him for vast lengths of time.
So in the original, it was Gailey who did that.
Yeah.
And she was, like, not too impressed that it had happened. In the remake, Gailey, or not Gailey, in that one, Bedford, says, oh, I've got a babysitter for you. And then he brings in the, you know, Santa, Kris Kringle. And she's like, oh, and he's like, no, it's fine. You know, who better to be a babysitter than Santa Claus? And then she's like, okay. But literally, like, two scenes beforehand, she'd been talking about being concerned that he was unstable.
Yeah.
And that he was just a moment away from doing something wrong that would, you know, harm someone. And then she's like, yeah, okay, I guess I'll leave him alone with my child for hours while we go for a date. And it's like, hello, what? What do you mean? If you're worried he's unstable, don't do that.
It's also that scene, because you mentioned it when we were watching the remake, because there's a scene where he's being Santa in the Macy's place, or Kohl's.
Kohl's.
And they bring this orphan in, and, like, you're like...
No, so yeah, so in the original...
In the original, so she's an orphan.
She's a Dutch orphan who doesn't speak English yet because she's just come to the States.
Yeah.
In 1947.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where do you think she was before?
somewhere where they speak Dutch.
I think she was in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
I think her family may have been...
involved in the war of some way.
Yeah. And are no longer with her.
Yeah.
It's
very sweet that he, like, knows sign language.
Yeah, so in the original, obviously, he speaks Dutch to the little girl. And then in the remake, because they don't have a child who's just lost her parents in a Holocaust.
Yeah.
They have a little deaf girl who comes in.
Yeah.
And the actress was actually deaf and didn't know that Richard Attenborough had learned to sign.
That's amazing.
She was like...
That's genuine reaction.
Genuine reaction. When she gets delighted and then they have a whole conversation in sign language, which obviously wasn't quite scripted because she didn't know that he was going to sign to her. So that's quite sweet. Yeah, because you just see like her face light up when you know, and I think that's kind of adorable. But yeah, so in the remake, it's that he speaks her sign language. But I also liked that when he talks to Susan in the shop, and she says what her name is. She says Susan, and she asks, "Well, what's your name?" And then he's like, "Oh, I actually have many names," and he starts listing like what, you know, the figure of Saint Nicholas or Santa Claus is called in all these different cultures, and then he speaks to her in Swahili and is it Russian? I can't remember. He speaks a couple of languages, and she's like, "Oh," I think that's where her spark of belief starts to come from. That she's like, "Why would some guy who just wants to be a Santa in a toy shop?"
Yeah, it's also learn the fact all these that, languages. Like, in the remake, she's like 100% spying on him.
And oh and he turns and winks at her, and she's like, "Oh no."
He knows I'm doing investigations.
She was such a cute kid.
Yeah.
Mara Wilson was, like, adorable. Also, by the way, this is getting into trivia too soon, but the actress who played Susan in the original, Natalie Wood, didn't realize that Edmund Gwenn, who played Santa Claus, wasn't the real Santa Claus until they had, like, the rap party and he didn't have he took his beard off.
That's funny.
She thought he was just the real Santa Claus acting with her, which I think is very, very sweet. Kind of reminds me of, like, Drew Barrymore with E.T.
Yeah.
Thinking that E.T. was just, like, a real alien that they were acting with. Yeah, I think that's very sweet.
Oh, that's sad. I'm not going to mention that at all.
Okay.
What happened to her.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's sad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, what I was going to say was, it's, you sort of get to the turning point of the movie, where he ends up in court and he's in trouble. The 47 one has a lot of weird scenes in it that aren't connected, like aren't continued on in the remake, where he's like getting psychoanalyzed.
Yeah.
And then he psychoanalyzes the guy who's psychoanalyzing him.
So this is the thing.
And there's a very, like, Hannibal Lecter-esque scene in it. And he's like, "Oh, you bite your nails. Are you a nervous person?" It's like, "Oh, how's your family at home?" And then his wife rings him after he's, like, conducted the interview. And he shouts at her. And it's like, "Oh, this all makes sense." Like, he's literally, like, psychologically ripping this guy apart.
Yeah.
And it's so bananas because you're like, this is supposed to be Santa.
It's great. Also, in both of them, Santa has an anger problem.
Yeah.
And it's like, hey, like, why in both of these movies is Santa so quick to resort to violence? I don't like that about him.
Mm.
Because otherwise he's just, like, a really loving guy. Now, in fairness, he is being provoked.
Yeah.
But, like, why, in both movies he hits people with his cane, which is not what you want from a Santa. I was gonna say, yeah, the original there was the guy who was like the psych guy on staff but was not a licensed psychiatrist. So there was like, so this, you know, Kris Kringle had no problem going along to him to be like, "Yeah, I'm being evaluated for, you know, that I'm okay to do this job."
Yeah.
But then he realized that like one of the other young and impressionable staff members was going to this guy on a weekly basis, and the guy was, like, acting like a psychiatrist to him and really undermining his self-esteem and stuff, and then that's what really angered him, because he was like, "You're not actually a licensed psychiatrist." He was like, "I have a lot of time for actual psychiatry. That's not what you're doing here. You just want to, you're on some kind of power trip." And then that's the guy who kind of becomes the cartoonish villain trying to get him committed. And faking being injured by him so that he can get him committed.
Yeah.
Whereas in the remake, it's
literally cartoonish villains.
Yeah, yeah. But the person that they get to kind of do all of the, like, faking being injured and stuff like that is
the drunk Santa from the drunk parade.
Santa from the beginning, whose job he took. I do like, there's a scene, it kind of reminds me of Jingle All the Way, where there's a scene where it's just, like, a whole load of mall Santas off duty in a bar still in their Santa suits.
Yeah.
And that's kind of funny to me. Yeah. It's like all these terrible Santas, well, all being shown up by this, like, fantastic Santa Claus who is the real Santa playing Santa.
All losing their jobs because of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a, there are, yeah, and then you go from that turning point to the actual court case, And, like, as you said, the original court case is much better than the remake.
Yeah, that kind of made me sad. So I thought if they're going to remake it and change it, like, they would have, like, a really good kind of courtroom drama type thing happening. But instead, like, Bedford, the nice guy, who I kept referring to as Handsome Ross, he genuinely...
Dylan McDermott.
Yeah, Dylan McDermott. I think specifically in this role, Dylan McDermott looks like if Ross from Friends wished to be handsome.
So he's got a handsome... He's handsome Squidward, but Ross.
Yeah, he's handsome Squidward, but Ross.
Yeah.
He's still got the kind of negative qualities of Ross.
Yeah.
But anyway, he just doesn't... He's just not even a good lawyer, I don't think. He literally... isn't. He does nothing to prove his case, and he's like, I just got to sit back and relax, and they have to prove it. And then they actually provide proof, and then the judge comes out and is like, listen, I like your guy, but this is how the evidence is going.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is, by the way, it's a hearing, not a trial in both cases. And then he's like, accuses the judge of being corrupt and bribed.
Very interesting, because it's true. The judge in both these movies is corrupt, because you get some shady character coming in and being like, hey, so about your re-election.
Yeah, but in the remake, the guy comes in, the DA comes in and talks to him, and he's like, oh yeah, it sounds like it's going to be an easy case. And then he starts talking about all that stuff, and you can see the judge change, that he's not having any of it.
Yeah.
So I don't think he accepted whatever bribe he was being offered.
Yeah, but he definitely is, like, on the fence in the original.
Oh, yeah, in the original, it's very much... but I don't think in the original he's necessarily being bribed, I think. And also he's going on the side of Santa.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not that he's being bribed. It's that, like, whoever his, like, campaign manager or whatever is like, a devil on his shoulder being like, you gotta consider how your re-election campaign's gonna go. Whereas in the remake, it's like, well, Lumbag or whatever his name is going to fund your campaign if you, respond favorably in this hearing.
It's very interesting because for those who don't know, it's for the comic book world, Gotham, as in from DC, is based on New York City at night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sort of more New Jersey, New York, so that sort of side of it. And, like, the Mafia were involved in New York from the get-go, right from the beginning. That's where you get all those, you know, Italian, you know, New Jersey, The Sopranos, all the gangster movies that are set in New York City or New Jersey.
When you said Italians in New Jersey, my mind immediately went to Cake Boss.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I was like, he's not in the Mafia, I don't think. So
to the point where the federal government during World War II paid the Mafia money to protect the dockyards, because otherwise they were going to get ripped off by the Mafia. So they were like, let's just cut out the robbery part and literally just pay them to protect, like... So you have the federal government paying the Mafia protection money. Like, that's how influential they were. You talk about unions who were all formed, like, by shady business deals. Concrete costs way more to pour in New York than any other place in the United States, because the fact that everything is controlled by unions, and the unions were all there for, like, you know... It's a very interesting history of the actual... construction of New York, that whole state.
Yeah.
So it's very fascinating. You get to this sort of like point in the movie where it's just like, we could go either way. We could like this other guy.
Yeah.
What I found fascinating from the original to the remake is, other than the toxicity that is in the original, it's sort of all very wrapped up in a bow at the end of it, where spoiler alert for the movie, the girl wants a house and a family. That's what she wants for Christmas, and that's what her test is for Santa Claus.
Yeah, though I think in the original she just wants the house.
Yeah, she wants the house. Because
she doesn't want to live in a little apartment anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
She wants a house.
With a swing in the backyard.
Yes.
And then they're like, there's this cane, like, on the mantle. Like.
Yeah, yeah, he gives them directions home from where he's invited them to a Christmas party thing. And then it's, yeah, on the directions they take, they end up at this, or outside this house that's for sale. That's exactly the house she had shown him.
It's very interesting too, because like we've watched quite a bit of lawyer-based shows that are sort of based on real law, unlike a lot of law shows which are based on funniness.
Like the one I'm currently rewatching.
Yeah, Ally McBeal.
Which is definitely not suitable for children.
Yeah, definitely not. It's interesting that because in the original, he represents Santa Claus in court himself. But you see clips where McDermott is literally working for a law firm.
Right.
So there would be some interesting, like, stuff that's not in the movie because... Yeah. You, as a lawyer, can't just take clients that don't approach the law firm also, without affecting the law firm and how it appears to other people.
Yeah. Also, in the remake, Dory has to ask him to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas in the original, he just, like, immediately shows up, like, to the point that Chris doesn't know what's going to happen. And they're like, this is your legal representative. And he's like, hey, it's me. Mm. Funny meeting you here. You know, and I do think that despite his undermining of Doris's parenting, I think that Mr. Gailey in the original has a lot of, he just like has high moral values himself. And I think, you know, and I think that the undermining comes from a positive place in that like he's trying, he thinks, you know, that the way she's raising her daughter is going to make her too cynical or whatever, yeah. And he wants her to have joy in her life, which is fair, but again, that should be a discussion with the parent, let's just do this while your mom's not here and see how we go.
It's interesting because there is a very strong relationship within the trio of them. You know, you've got that sort of, almost Wendy the Welder kind of attitude from the mum of like, you know, strong women can get this together. You know, they took a lot of men's jobs during the era of the war. Obviously, there was a huge paradigm shift because of that, because more people were in the actual economy itself needed women in the workplace. Because, you know, a lot of people didn't come home. And you know, there was a huge industry that was built around, you know, the war. More in that era than sort of in the 90s, where this is set, where it was sort of more commonplace to have women in quite high positions within businesses. And it wasn't strange. There is a weird power dynamic between the two of them, because he is clearly missing out on, he's obviously focused quite heavily on his career, his life.
Yeah.
Ignoring, you know, making up excuses of why he's a lawyer in the end of the war. Could be lots of reasons. Because there was a lot of people who couldn't go to war because they weren't physically fit enough or healthy enough.
But even then, there also are people who went to war and came back and went back to their jobs.
Yeah, it's true.
So we don't know what his background
exactly,
is.
Without, like, making up a hypothetical there. There is definitely something missing in his life, and it is the desire to be a parent, the desire to have, you know, that IKEA nesting instinct of building a home and putting things in it. And it very, very is dependent on, like, you know, his relationship with the mother and the little girl. And obviously the little girl's very happy with it. She's more focused around, like, is Christmas real? There's a lot of interesting sort of power dynamic things there that could be quite heavily explored. One of the things that you brought up multiple times, which I keep forgetting to mention, the lighting in the 94 one is so good.
I wish movies were lit like that these days. It's got that, like, for people who haven't seen it, it's just, when there's like a close-up of someone, they have obviously like a soft light that's directly on their face, that's like, you know, like diffused light that like highlights their features essentially, and it makes it very clear this is the focus of the camera. And nowadays that kind of lighting is just lost in most films, and I don't know why that's happened. And it very much, even though it's a 90s film, it felt like the kind of way that a lot of black and white movies were lit.
Yeah.
Like, it felt like film noir kind of lighting.
I hope the fact that the original was black and white was the mentality from that, because I've seen the other movies this person was cinematography for, Home Alone 2, for an example, and it's not the same.
No, yeah.
So maybe that's what they did. Maybe they were just like, hey, look, let's film this like we were filming black and white.
Yeah, that might be it, that they just really wanted it. Maybe they just really wanted it to look like classic cinema.
Yeah.
Especially when they're remaking a movie that was so well, like, beloved.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's just something, like, the fact that, like, we're watching this movie from the 90s in 2025, and we're just going, wow, look at this lighting.
Yeah.
You know, they made a choice, and it worked really well.
Yeah. It's not in every scene, it's just in the intimate scenes between McDormand and the mother.
Mm.
McDermott. Yeah, it's an interesting way to do it. I would agree with you. As much as good as the original is, I did prefer the remake personally. I feel like I just have more of an attachment to early 90s stuff. It's probably my born in the 80s nostalgia stuff.
Well, look, I do think I really, really loved Richard Attenborough as Santa Claus.
Like,
what a good Santa.
Just what a great actor.
Yeah.
I was constantly waiting for him to scream Jurassic Park. I don't know if it was before or after, 94?
Jurassic Park was the year before, it was 93.
Yeah, I was just going to say, it's earlier 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was great. I didn't realize he was a director in a bunch of stuff as well.
Yeah, he was an Oscar-winning director.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Speaking of which, this is probably the last of my trivia, actually, but the guy who played Santa in the original is the only actor to have ever won an Oscar for portraying Santa.
Wow.
What do you think of, like, the amount of Christmas movies or the amount of actors who have played Santa over the years? Decently impressive. But yeah, Richard Attenborough, I don't think he ever won an Oscar for acting, but he definitely won for directing, if I remember correctly. Maybe I'm misremembering that, but I think he did.
He was also in the war.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, of course he would be. Yeah. He won 2 Oscars. What did he win for? Gandhi.
Okay.
Best director and best picture. There you go.
Fair enough. I don't particularly like that movie, but that's
well, that's Richard Attenborough's Oscar-winning direction. Yeah. Sorry, that word got away from me.
Yeah.
He didn't direct a lot, though. But I mean, I think a lot of what he directed is pretty well known.
Mm.
So, but yeah, obviously very well known as Hammond in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
He's another actor who's probably on our list of actors who've appeared in many films we've talked about, because he was in The Great Escape.
Yeah.
Which is one of our first episodes. I'm mentioning this, we haven't talked about this on the podcast, but when we were watching these movies, I was talking about Mara Wilson potentially being up there as one of the actors who appears in the most It Takes Two episodes.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of which have not been recorded or released yet. We are going to do at least one more Mara Wilson film. How many have we done so far?
Mara Wilson films?
Yeah.
That's a good question.
Have we just done this and Mrs. Doubtfire so far?
Filmography. Mrs. Doubtfire was 93. Miracle on 34th Street was 94. Have we done Matilda?
No, but we will do Matilda.
Okay, so that'll only be 3, because I don't think we've done A Simple Wish.
Thomas and the Magic Railroad. I loved A Simple Wish, but I don't know what you could possibly compare it to. Have you seen A Simple Wish?
No.
I really loved it as a kid. It's she makes a wish, and her fairy godmother is Martin Short. And it's really strange.
Do you know who her cousin is?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, she is. She has been very outspoken about that online.
Yeah, I was like, oh no.
Yeah. Mara Wilson is very vocal online about a lot of things, I think. Mm. Openly bisexual as well. I think she is on the spectrum in real life.
I don't think you can be, like, a great childhood actor without it. Because, like, no, because, like, when you look at, you know, when you watch a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff, you realize, like, there's a lot of work that goes into movies. And people tend to forget that these days because of the mocap stuff, because a lot of stuff is CGI. But, like, there was a point in time where people would make the most over-the-top, like, Ben-Hur, for an example.
Yeah.
It's got, like, a GDP of, like, a small country, the cost of that movie. It's so insane. And, you know, one of our other favorite Christmas movies, which we have covered on the podcast, which was The Grinch with Jim Carrey, literally had to get a CIA operative to train him how to go through torture because of the makeup routine. And that's why he refused to, like, step anywhere near a sequel, because they did offer him a lot of money to do a sequel. And he was just like, no way. You forget that, like, there's a famous scene, because people pointed out, from Back to the Future 3.
Yeah.
Where one of the kids makes a very strange-looking gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was literally letting the people in the background know that he needed to go to the bathroom. But because he's, like, a background character in this shot, like, it's ended up into the final cut of the movie.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, most childhood actors, and you look at, like, what happened to Macaulay Culkin, they don't have great lives.
Yeah,
and the kid who played poor Anakin in Phantom Menace, like, had a terrible life after that movie came out.
And our favorite movie, Jingle All the Way.
Yeah.
Where he plays Jamie.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to look up Mara Wilson's Wikipedia page.
Because she still
doesn't mention being on the spectrum, but she has talked about having anxiety, depression, and obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah.
Which are a cocktail that would, you know, have a similar effect, maybe.
Yeah.
She's very outspoken about mental health, mental illness. She came out as bisexual in the aftermath of a tragedy. I was going to mention what it was, but again, this is a child-friendly episode, so we don't want to get too specific. She's been very vocal about defending young actresses when public have been criticizing them. She also apparently currently works for a New York City-based nonprofit that repaints public schools.
That's cool.
That's really nice. I think she's an author as well.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I'm just, like, we're both scrolling through the same thing. a name popped out at me.
I didn't see the author coming up here, but I remember that just from being aware of who she is.
Because she's a narrator in The Faceless Old Woman Who Secretly Lives in Your Home by Joseph Fink.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know Joseph Fink? You'll know who Joseph Fink is.
From Welcome to Night Vale. She was in Welcome to Night Vale.
She was, yeah.
Yeah. Did she play the faceless old woman?
Yeah, she's the faceless old woman that lives in your house.
Yeah, so she plays that character in the actual podcast, Welcome to Night Vale as well. Yeah. She's in a lot of cool things, actually, I think. I think she's one of those people that, like, got a public platform and then has done her best to really use that for good.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Yep. Gilmore Girls is herself. That's weird. it's really difficult. Sort of also coming out of that as well. And that's, you know, it's been mentioned many a time of child actors sort of having that sort of, you know, you're cute, you're hot, you're not hot as in, like, hot for the industry, not hot Well, that does become a problem later on, but that's a subject for another day.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things that she defends young actresses against.
Yeah, yeah.
You're
a commodity.
You're a good actor, and you fit this, like, cuteness profile, or just, like, this is the, you know... the child that's got screen presence, and then they want to put you in everything.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And then you get to a point where she doesn't
have a lot of credits. For someone who is, like, iconically a big child actor in the 90s, she actually doesn't have a lot of credits. But yeah, she definitely was the child actor for a very short window, like 1992 to 1997 or something. She was
the
child actor.
You know, we, as I mentioned earlier, Home Alone, and so many Olsen twin movies.
Yeah. Haley Joel Osment then was the probably the next one after Mara Wilson. Dakota Fanning.
Yeah.
Who I've recently seen, she's gone back to acting, and I've recently seen her in, acting in a couple of things as an adult, and and she is a good actress still, and it was nice to see that, because she obviously took a break for quite a while, but she was in everything, I felt like, Dakota Fanning, when she was younger, and she, again, was spectacular child actress.
Yeah, it's very...
It started at a very young age.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting industry for her to be, you know, trying to grow up in. And you get a lot of, you've got to get a lot of respect to childhood actors, and, like I said earlier, it does probably help if you can really dive in, because most kids are just, like, I remember myself as a kid, and I was, like, very weird as a child, and, you know, it's not normal childhood behavior, but a lot of the things, you know, like, I was commented saying that I was 9 going on 90, and it's because I'm probably on the spectrum as well.
Look.
What are you looking?
So Mara Wilson was born in 87, and then it looks like her kind of first roles were in 92, 93.
Yeah.
Dakota Fanning was born in 1994, and it's, and her Wikipedia article says her professional acting career began in 1999.
Yeah.
It's like, that's a 5-year-old.
Yeah.
her professional acting career began with roles in ER and CSI.
Yeah. It's very difficult. Good on them. But, you know, all the horrible stuff that happens is not good.
Yeah. It's also, because I've read Jeanette McCurdy's book, which is called I'm Glad My Mom Died, which is a bit of a shocker of a title, but as you read the book, you kind of understand. And it's, I think, the important thing, because it's so difficult, because obviously, you know, to some extent there needs to be child actors. But it's very much like there's such a line between this is a child who's interested in acting, and this is a parent who wants their child to be a star.
And there's also the other issue of that is, because a lot of child stars, especially when they get super famous, get paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
Where that money goes becomes a court case.
Yeah.
And then obviously no one remembers the name of the parents, but everyone remembers the name of the adult. And obviously there's a lot of stuff that happens as they grow up.
Yeah.
A lot of parasitic relationships, losing of friends, you know, it's a tough industry for anybody, but even tougher when your brain isn't fully developed.
We can talk about this more when we do a Matilda episode, but my understanding is that, like, part of why Mara Wilson kind of didn't have as many problems, because it's usually about the support of parents.
Yeah.
But Mara Wilson's mother died when she was quite young. And she was basically taken under the wing of Danny DeVito, who seems like a really lovely person. Danny DeVito and his wife, Rhea Perlman.
Yeah.
And I think that relationship probably
helped a lot.
Yeah. And probably shaped how she responded to fame and things like that. Which is, you know, nice to have someone like that. And it's, you know, the same with, you know, for example, the Harry Potter actors.
Yeah.
That the adult cast that were working with them, like, I've heard, you know, some of the people who played kids in Harry Potter talk about Alan Rickman and Gary Oldman, and, you know, how they kind of looked after them on set and gave them help towards, you know, dealing with the publicity they were getting.
Yeah.
Anyway, Christmas.
Christmas indeed.
I liked these movies. I'm sure a lot of people listening have already seen one or both of these versions of this film. Because they are...
Or allegedly read the book that's just a...
Yeah, I read the book. Not knowing it was a novelization of the movie rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
But there is a book. You can read the book. I think it also came out in the 40s, so like it came out pretty shortly after the original, but not before it.
Thank you for joining us on this episode, because you've run out of trivia. We've run out of
things. Basically. We'll see you in 2026.
Yeah, this will be the last episode of 2025, which is... It's been a year. Ups and downs, lefts and rights.
Yeah, I'll do my usual kind of top episodes of the year.
Yep.
Based on people's... Or, like, the most listened to episodes of the year.
And if you've followed us from 2024, thank you very much. Share with your friends. Go to our website, ittakes2.co.nz. And you can follow us on social media and join our Discord. And we hope to see you again in 2026.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.